Do Your Divorce Right, and other advice from two Maine family court judges. When families are in disarray and the issues end up in a courtroom, there are ways to minimize the trauma and optimize the chances for a positive solution. That's the message from two family court judges who are my guests today on Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall, and we're talking once again with Superior Court Judge Andrew Mark Horton and District Court Judge John David Kennedy, co-authors of the book Do Your Divorce Right, Straight Talk from Family Court Judges. We'd like to hear from you as well. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a message on Facebook, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Got a comment? Tell it to the judge. This is Maine Calling. And welcome back, Judges Horton and Kennedy. We spoke to you, it was back in May, and there was a lot that we didn't get to, in particular on the issue of the impact of divorces and separations on children, which is covered in your book, Do Your Divorce Right, Straight Talk from Family Court Judges. As we did in that program, once again, we'll open the program with a disclaimer, and that is that these are two sitting judges who cannot comment on pending cases and who are not here to give legal advice on your particular case if you are before a court at the moment. However, they might offer some advice on how to negotiate the court system and how to make things go more smoothly. Judge Horton, in the case of divorce, children are not just caught in the crossfire sometimes. They're brought in as part of the dispute. What are the long-term effects that it has on them in the worst of cases?
You're right. Oftentimes, the focus of the entire case is upon the children of the relationship or the marriage, if it is a marriage, and the future of those children in terms of the level of contact with each parent and the resident. The research is pretty clear that how the parents manage a separation and a divorce has a direct effect on the long-term, not only the immediate emotional well-being of the children, but their long-term prospects. And specifically, the research of Judith Wallerstein and other researchers indicates clearly that chronic parental conflict can take a lasting toll on children. It can affect the children's ability to form their own relationships over a lifetime and have other significant negative effects. And the courts are well aware of that, and we do everything we can to try to steer cases from taking that direction.
Judge Kennedy, have you witnessed the effects on children who have been through some of these situations?
More times than I'd like, and sometimes really directly and other times more indirectly. Occasionally, even though I don't like to do this, if the parties agree, sometimes I will agree to talk to a child in chambers. I almost never allow a child to be a witness in the courtroom. And so sometimes I get it right from the child's mouth, but more often I see it indirectly. But I think for me, the most memorable story was a day that I was down in Biddeford and I was doing juvenile criminal cases. And a probation officer who I respect very much came in, and the next young woman was brought in a green jumpsuit and in shackles. And the probation officer said, you know, Judge, I want you to commit her to Long Creek until she's 21. And it just didn't seem right to me. She was well-groomed and looked me in the eye, and all of the kinds of things that you look for seem to be positive. And so this isn't the kind of young person who the probation department would usually be wanting to commit for a long time. And so I said to the probation officer, what's going on here? And he pointed to both of the parents who were separately seated in the front row of the courtroom, but at the extreme ends, as far away as they could be from each other. And he said, Judge, you know, we've tried everything. We've tried substance abuse counseling. We've tried group homes. We've tried inpatient substance abuse. And we're out of options. We have no other options but to incarcerate this young woman. And I believe it's entirely due to the fact that she's been in the middle of the parents' divorce for the past 5 years, and she can't cope with it. And I thought then, and I think now, I wish I'd had a video camera going. And I wish that somehow we had videotaped that, and so I could show it to people who are heading down that path and say, is this really where you want your kid to end up? Because if you continue to act the way you are, there's a strong possibility that I'm going to be seeing your child in a juvenile criminal case.
Most judges are instructed or are guided by this principle of acting or deciding cases in the best, what's called the best interest of the child, as opposed to the best interest of the parents in this case. Judge Horton, what does that mean, best interest of the child?
Good question. And it's obviously a question that in particular cases is debated heavily. Maine law, and Maine law is consistent with the law of other states, points judges to focus on essentially every aspect of the child's life in terms of deciding best interests of the child. Things like the child's living environment, which parent has been there for the child, which parent is able to provide the most supportive living environment for the child. One of the factors, in fact, that judges are required to consider is which parent will do the most to support the child's relationship with the other parent, which is not something that parents think about much, but that is one of the factors we focus on. And so oftentimes custody decisions, et cetera, are made in favor of the child, in favor of the parent who is willing and able to foster the child's relationship with the other parent. If more parents knew that and knew that that's one of the things we're supposed to look at and do look at, they might approach situations very differently.
Keith, if I can, I'd like to follow that up. The first best interest case was in 1925 in New York. It was written by Justice Cardozo, who's one of the giants of American law. And he said that the trial judge is supposed to act as though the judge is a wise, affectionate parent of the child and focus on the child's long-term best interests as opposed to what the two positions are. And I've always liked that phrase. Not that we're always able to do it, but that's what we ought to aspire to.
But you go into a case not having all the information. You have the versions from the two parents, and depending on the age of the child, you have some input from the child, but you don't really have all the facts in order to be that informed, wise parent. Do you just go on your intuition or the best information you have?
Well, first of all, we're required to act on the evidence that's been presented in the courtroom, not other things we might guess.
Hearsay.
Or certainly not hearsay. And I'm a big believer of the proposition that the truth ultimately comes out. It might not come out when we need it, but it does ultimately come out. And I often worry in these cases, am I making the right decision? But I think experience shows that if I haven't made the right decision, that one way or another the case is likely to come back and the truth will have come out and there'll be more information and we'll have an opportunity to change things.
Some of the advice in here was, I was reviewing it this morning, and the advice to parents, which chapter 4 you say is a must read for parents with children who are going through this situation. One of the pieces of advice you give is don't come across as a crackpot. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. crackpots, in my experience, don't really know that they're a crackpot in the first place. But the point here is that you're making an impression in front of a judge who is going to decide who the most reasonable and the most reasonable parent is and who can function as a reasonable parent, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that we look at, but if I had to say one thing to anybody who is coming to court in a family case having to do with children especially, it's don't lie, don't exaggerate. Because if you get caught in a lie or if you're shown to be hyperbolic, that's about the worst thing that can happen to you because it then calls into question everything that you've said. and how much weight can the judge give it? How much can the judge trust anything that you said? So, you know, if you have a question in the back of your mind about whether or not you should say something, that's probably a pretty good indication that you shouldn't.
There's also an anecdote in Chapter 4, which talks about a father who collected a great deal of evidence trying to paint a dark picture of his wife rather than painting a positive picture of himself. That was his strategy. Does that work, Judge Orton?
That actually comes from my own experience in a particular case. And obviously, as the author of that or the recounter of that anecdote, in my view, it didn't work. And that's really a message that I think any family court judge would like to send to parents, is that if your focus is on what is best for the child and you are willing to acknowledge that in some ways it may be in the child's best interest for the child to have a good, strong relationship with the other parent, you're likely to come across as far more credible, far more balanced, and to impress the judge as someone who ought to be entrusted with decision-making authority and perhaps custody, to use that term. Custody is not a term that is used often in Maine. We talk about primary residence because that's the term in the law that refers to the parent who has the child most of the time.
I wanted to talk about the quote that you chose to begin Chapter 4. The chapter is, "If you have children together." This is a quote from Pope John Paul II. I don't know if one of you would read it for me and explain why you chose it.
Well, I think David and I kind of came up with what we thought were apropos quotes for each chapter, and I think I might have come up with this one. The quote is, "To maintain a joyful family requires much from both the parents and the children. Each member of the family has to become, in a special way, the servant of the others." And again, this is from Pope John Paul II. And my thought in choosing that quote was to steer the people who were reading this chapter, who would be the parents, to think in terms of the best interest of the child, to think in terms of how they, in the course of handling their separation and divorce, could really elevate the child's best interests ahead of their own, serve the child's best interest, to use the servant word.
We have a message on Facebook from Amy who writes, "What do you think of parental alienation? Do you feel the process of divorce and post-divorce litigation contributes to the problem?" She goes on to explain that mom often alienates children from the dads. How can this process be improved to curb this? I assume there are cases where both mom and dad try to alienate the other. Is there a role for the judge in those cases?
Yes, absolutely. Parental alienation is a phenomenon that exists, and there are people who debate whether or not there's something called the parental alienation syndrome, and there's been a lively debate about that over the years. I think the weight of the academic studies is that there's not a specific syndrome. Nevertheless, we both have seen cases in which both fathers and mothers have been equally at fault in trying to get the child on their side and coach them what to say. I would say two things about it. First of all, that's a pretty good indicator that you have a high conflict case. And so the judge is likely to bring some additional resources to bear. And maybe that's referring the parties to the Kids First program. Maybe it's appointing a guardian ad litem to do some additional investigation. Maybe it's appointing a parenting coordinator. All of those are tools we use in high conflict cases. The second thing I would say is that it's been my experience, if you look at things over the long term, and you really do have to take the long view here, parental alienation almost always backfires against the parent who has been the person who's initiated it, if not before, at least when the child becomes an adult and looks back and figures out what happened to him or her and who stole their childhood.
And those cases do come back before the court, don't they? They don't just go away and...
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. I think the worst case I've ever seen was a case that had been essentially continuously litigated for 14 years.
Exhausting and bad for everyone.
One does, on a fairly regular basis, see kids at the high school age who make a conscious choice to move out from the parent who's had them for much of the time and move in with the other parent. I've seen a number of those cases. And the reasons for that are not always clear, but in a couple of cases that I can think of, it was because the child felt as though the scale had tipped too far in favor of one parent, and the child was looking for a way to equalize it. When we talk to kids in terms of their own preferences, and we are required to explore preferences, certainly when a child wants to express them, one of the strongest preferences that, at least in my case, I've heard, is not so much for specific outcomes, but for things to be fair or things to be equal. And so kids are very sensitive to that, and that's why Judge Kennedy is absolutely right that children know what's happening. They know when they're being coached. They know when they're being alienated. Whether or not it's a syndrome, it does happen, and at least in the long term, it doesn't work.
All right. We'll ask more about that. Talk more about that in a moment after the break. Your comments and questions, email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment on our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
100 years ago, newspaper headlines screamed about Malaga Island, just off the coast of Phippsburg, Maine.
Poverty, immorality, and disease.
Life on Malaga. Not fit for dogs.
45 people lived on Malaga Island. They were black, white, and mixed race.
A shameful disgrace that should be looked after at once.
In 1912, the state of Maine evicted the community. 8 were sent to the Maine School for the Feeble-Minded. Even the graveyard was dug up and moved. The Malaga community was erased. Malaga Island, A Story Best Left Untold, is a radio documentary about the eviction and its aftermath. It's produced by WMPG-FM from the University of Southern Maine. Please join us for Malaga Island, A Story Best Left Untold, right here on this station.
You can tune in for that special program immediately following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're learning how to do a divorce right, as their book explains, and stories from two men with long histories in adjudicating family law. With me in the studio, Mark Horton. He's been a judge since 1999, and first on the Maine District Court judge, and now in the Maine Superior Court. David Kennedy was appointed as a judge of the Maine District Court in 2002 and sits in the District Court of Midcoast, Maine. We'd like you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We mentioned before the break about how important it is to bring in the child, to talk to the child who's involved. And how do you do that, though? You have a four-year-old. How do you talk to a four-year-old and get from them what they might prefer?
Well, I don't. That's the easy answer to that. A 16-year-old might be a different story. In a best-case scenario, I'm never going to have a child come near the courthouse. I'm going to get my information indirectly, and there are various ways to do that. And again, in a contested case, it might be through a guardian ad litem, or it might be through a psychological evaluation. But having a child get involved in the parent's conflict is not a good idea. But kids' views are entitled to be given more weight the older they are. And ultimately, at about 16, as Justice Horton said earlier, they're going to sometimes start voting with their feet. There are cases where it's appropriate to talk for the judge to talk to the child in chambers. And the way to do that often, if I have to, is to have the child come in on another day when the parents aren't there and have a conversation with the judge. And I say to the child that this conversation can't be confidential. I'm going to have to reveal to the parties in one way or another what you say, but I'm not going to specifically quote you if I can avoid it. And sometimes you get in a situation where the information that you get from the child is the key that unlocks the case. It can be terrifically helpful. I vividly remember speaking with two young men in chambers, and I'm kind of in my little intro about, you know, what do you do? Where do you go to school? And the older one of the brothers looked at me and said, look, you can cut all that out. We know why we're here. And we're here to tell you that the only thing you may not do is split us up. And I looked at them and I said, okay, I won't. They didn't have a particular preference as to which parent they spent most of their time with, but they wanted me to know for sure that they wanted to stay together.
Don't some kids, though, feel like they're picking between parents and they're doing it in front of a stranger in a robe? It must be really hard.
What part of our training is not to put kids in that situation unless they volunteer to be, in effect. So when I've met with kids in chambers, as Judge Kennedy described, often it's simply to ask a few questions about how things are going and try to create a level of rapport so that if the child does want to share a point of view or pass something along, that the comfort level is established. But for a judge to ask a child, so who would you rather live with, mom or dad? I mean, that is absolutely out of bounds. And sometimes they'll tell you, but it really needs to come from them. And oftentimes signals will be sent and messages, subliminal messages will be conveyed that give you a pretty good idea of where the child is coming from.
And sometimes we can absolutely tell, and I know this has happened to both of us because we've talked about it, that you have a child come in who's clearly been totally coached by one parent or the other and has been programmed to say X or Y or Z. And frankly, that's pretty obvious when it happens.
Will you ask them?
No.
Were you coached?
Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
Well, so I have occasionally in a couple of asked the child, do you know what your dad would like to have happen? Or do you know what your mom would like to have happen? In a couple of cases, the child has said, yes, I know what one parent wants and I don't know what the other parent wants, which is revealing in itself.
Judge Kennedy, you mentioned guardian ad litem. We have a question about that from Lebanon and Angelique. Hi, Angelique.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi, I have a long custody battle that happened a long time ago, but I was left with a lingering question about the judge's decision on which guardian ad litem to choose. In our case, one lawyer was asking for a specific one, and they went with that one, and then doing some research on the person's website, they blatantly state, I do not believe in 50-50 custody, which is what we were going for. And I didn't know if there's a reason behind that or if that's common at all.
Can you explain what guardian ad litem is and does first?
Sure. Guardian ad litems are people who are either mental health professionals or attorneys who've been rostered by the court system to act in a capacity as someone whose function is to protect the best interests of the child. So the guardian does really two things. And one is to go out and investigate. And then the second is to make recommendations, whatever they might be. To respond more particularly to the question, actually, most of the time now, it's family magistrates who pick the guardian, not the judges, because that typically happens fairly early on in the life of the case at a case management conference when the family magistrate is doing that. And I used to be a family magistrate, so I can speak to that. It sometimes happens that the judge is in that position to do it. And what I most often will do is if both parties or both parties' attorneys agree on who the guardian should be, then I'm very likely to pick that person. If they don't agree, I'm likely to ask each of them to nominate three people. And in really contentious cases, I might decide not to pick any of those six people, but to go out and pick someone else on my own. I will sometimes try and match what I believe to be a particular guardian's skill set with the needs of the family. So there's one guardian who I'm thinking about who is particularly skilled in dealing with troubled adolescents. From my point of view, she has a very useful magic touch in dealing with young people who have some kind of issue. And so she is a person who I would think of if the case involved a troubled adolescent.
But just to follow up on the question as well, I can't imagine that a family law magistrate or a judge would be involved in selecting a guardian based upon the guardian's philosophy to produce a particular outcome. I mean, that which is really what the questioner is suggesting happened. Now, do the attorneys go and look for guardians whose recommendations are likely to be consistent with their client's objectives? Sure, they do. But it's the magistrate and the judge's job to make sure that the guardian who was ultimately selected is appropriate for the job.
And there's one other point I want to make about guardians. They are tremendously useful in many cases for judges. They make a recommendation, but that doesn't take away from the fact that it's ultimately our call, not theirs. And there are guardians who I respect very much who've recommended that I do X or Y in one case. And for whatever reason, good or bad, I've decided that their recommendation isn't what I think is best for the child or the family. And I think people who think that the guardian's recommendation is necessarily going to drive the outcome of the case are not correct in that. It's sometimes or even often true, but it's not always true.
Angelique, how would you characterize your experience in the court?
Sure. I'm actually a stepmom, but walking through with my husband through this, it was difficult, and it was very, there's a lot of factors behind what happened. Ultimately, everybody gets along now, and it's 50-50 custody, but it was very perplexing to me why we would have selected and it might have been just that the person didn't know that this guardian litem had that philosophy, but it was very evident when we sat down and have a conversation with him that he felt very much that mother should have all the guardianship. So that just kind of, and the judge didn't agree with that, in the end the guardian agreed with, that whatever the judge decided, there was no reason why the father couldn't have as much custody, but it was very surprising, and it just left. This is years ago now, but it was just always had that lingering question about why she would select a guardian ad litem that was very blatant that didn't believe in that 50-50 custody, and all I could think of was that she must not have known.
Angelique, thanks for the call. 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. That's 1-800-399-3566. Judge Horton, the caller mentioned this particular guardian ad litem had a problem with 50-50 custody, or however we call it. Are there schools of thought about that 50-50 is arbitrary and may not work, or that there should one parent should have primary custody? Are there schools of thought, I guess, amongst judges?
I'm not sure schools of thought, but certainly in my experience, 50-50 custody, and to be clear, that's a situation where the child spends about half the time with each parent. In my experience, that's successful in some cases. In some cases, it's not. And my impression is that sometimes it works better for the parents than for the child. There is something to be said for a child having a center of gravity, having a defined home, whichever parent provides that home. Again, there are situations where 50-50 sharing is a good thing for the child. The case that I can think of where it really worked well was where the parents lived on the same block. The child could essentially go back and forth between the houses without getting rides, and there really didn't need to be a schedule because the child was, I don't know, 11 or 12, as I recall, and sort of decided what the schedule mm-hmm. would be.
But less so if they're in a different state. We'll talk more about this in a moment. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
It's been a year since the U.S. debt downgrade, a perfect time for a look back at who was right about what it would mean and what it didn't mean.
Contrary to what I think people may expect, I don't expect we'll pay more for interest rates. The downgrade was not an economic event. It was a symbolic and psychological event.
Give that man a gold medal. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Downgrade Prognostication Olympics, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30.
To the women who say they are not feminists, Catelyn Moran asks,
what part of liberation for women is not for you? Is it the freedom to vote? The right not to be owned by the man that you marry?
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Moran about her new book, How to Be a Woman. It's a bestseller in Britain. She's a columnist for the Times of London. Join us.
And you can join us for Fresh Air immediately following Marketplace at 7 o'clock. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Adventure Bound Rafting, offering whitewater rafting, camping, ropes course, and rock climbing vacations for youth and families. AdventureBoundRafting.com.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the judges, Mark Horton, a Superior Court judge, and David Kennedy was appointed a judge of the Maine District Court and sits in the District Court in Midcoast, Maine. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk at mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. We were talking before the break about how to arrange custody, as we call it in the vernacular here. Easier when mom and dad or ex-mom and dad live down the street from each other. Not so easy when one lives in New Hampshire and one's in Maine.
Well, not only that, but even if one lives in South Portland and the other lives in Skowhegan, which is not uncommon. So I think the biggest factor that you have to deal with in a shared primary residence situation, which is what people mean when they talk about shared custody usually, is the school. Which one of the two school districts is the child going to go to? And that then practically drives a lot of the rest of the equation. And a lot of different factors go into that. Where does the child go to school now? Is he or she well adjusted? You know, is this a school system that's thought of as being good or bad? And how much, which parent is more likely to be involved and equipped to be helping out with the school, with the schoolwork?
Let's bring in Deborah, who's calling from Old Orchard Beach. Hi, Deborah.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
I want to know if the judges consider in a divorce the children, if the one parent, even though there's no-fault divorce, if one parent wants to leave the marriage to be with another person and take the children with her, and the other parent still wants the child and move out of state, what they consider in that.
We're assuming this is not a pending case, right, Deborah?
Right.
Those are two separate questions, actually. And one is, do we consider who's at fault, if you will, in the breakup of the marriage? And I would say, in general, we don't, period. Now, there are some exceptions to that rule. If one parent has a terrible substance abuse problem, and that's what's driven the breakup of the marriage, we're absolutely going to consider that.
But you don't make a moral judgment based on why they left and...
No, we don't. And a lot of people would like us to do that. Probably their fondest hope is that they're going to come to court and that one of us is going to look at them and say, you know, the other person is a bad person, so you win. And right. That just does not happen. So that's the answer to the first question. The second thing I would say about that is we commonly see people who want to introduce their new partner into their children's lives way too quickly. And all of the people who professionally understand that say that that's not something you want to rush into. And then the other question that the caller raised is moving out of state. That's called interstate relocation. And those are often the hardest cases that we have to deal with because even if the parents are getting along really well, if one of them wants to move to California, there's no way in either direction that the parent is going to be able, the parent who doesn't have primary residence is going to be able to maintain the same level of contact with the child. And often you have two very good parents and one who has very legitimate reasons for wanting to move, and they're really, really hard cases.
And in those situations, the courts often do focus on what happens if the parent who wants to move is allowed to take the child, and what happens if the opposite situation. Just so it's clear, the court is not going to tell a parent you can't move. The question is, can you take the children with you? And so we hear stories of people who want to move sometimes far away to live with someone that they've met online but never actually seen in person in some cases. And we're really assessing the wisdom and sensibility of that type of move. Those are the hardest cases are when someone has come to Maine for the marriage and at the time of the divorce wants to go back and live with their family where they came from, a legitimate reason. And that person has been the parent who has really been there for the children, taken the kids to doctor's appointments and really been there for the children in a way that the other parent hasn't. And yet for the court to allow that move with the children would have do tremendous damage to the relationship that the other parent has with the children.
Let's go to Durham, New Hampshire, and William. Hi, William. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. I've enjoyed the conversation. I have kind of a different, maybe outlying question, but in listening to your conversation, I found myself wondering if you see any impact as a result of these high-profile custody battles fought out in the press, you know, something like, you know, the Tom Cruise going through now and such. And whether you see that playing out in your courtroom, whether it's evidence in expectations of the parties, how they decide to approach that type of thing. So that's what I was wondering.
I think I would say, first of all, that when we appear on the radio and when we talk about cases, we tend to focus on the hard cases and the difficult ones. It's really easy to forget that probably half of our caseload are people who come into court who have a full agreement, and they just need the court to bless their agreement and be on the way and live the rest of their lives. So we tend to focus on the worst cases when we talk about them, not the majority of cases. I haven't seen a particular correlation between the celebrity divorces and behavior that I see in the courtroom, except to say that the overall standard of etiquette in our society has, in my view, gone down. And I would say to people, your mother was right. You know, you want to come to court neatly dressed and appropriately dressed, and you want to act well. And everything that you do or say or don't do or say is going to feed into the overall impression that the judge makes of you. So this is not a place to wear, your sexiest dress or your most incendiary T-shirt.
Right. I think it's fair to say, Tom, that judges are not influenced or affected by celebrity divorces and so forth. But we do recognize that sometimes the people who come into our courts see those celebrities as role models on some level. So I find myself, when one of those situations is played out in the newspapers or on TV or online, I find myself just hoping that the celebrities involved conduct themselves well so that those who look at them as role models will be given a good example.
Judge Kennedy, what are parenting coordinators?
Parenting coordinators are a relatively new thing in Maine. The legislature passed a statute about 3 years ago, I think. And they are people who are appointed by the court essentially as post-resolution coaches, people who have particular training in how co-parenting does and doesn't work. And they serve two functions. They can help the parties to grow into that role, hopefully. And secondly, they can decide issues of the moment as they come up. So if one parent wants to adjust the pickup time from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. on Friday, and the other parent doesn't want to do that, the parenting coordinator has the ability to say, no, what parent A is asking for is entirely reasonable, and that's what we're going to do this Friday. And sometimes, at least in the short term, that's what parties need, is a third party who has some training and experience who can resolve those things.
We've got less than a minute left. I just wanted to ask you, this, as we have these conversations, it strikes me how difficult your jobs are. I would think it would be very hard emotionally. It's a technically difficult. You have to handle a lot of information and people who are at their worst sometimes and at their best. Why do you do it?
Judge Kennedy and I were talking about that actually before coming on the show, and we both agreed that we've gotten over that I can't believe they're paying me to do this feeling about our jobs. But I think it's fair to say, and we've also discussed this, that we feel incredibly fortunate and really blessed on some level to have the jobs that we do. Yes, they are difficult. Yes, they are challenging. And yet, we always have the feeling, we always know when we go home that what we did that day is important, that it mattered. That takes us a long way.
All right. Well, thank you both very much for being here today. Andrew Mark Horton is on the Maine Superior Court, rather, and John David Kennedy sits on the District Court in Midcoast, Maine. Their book is Do Your Divorce Right, Straight Talk from Family Court Judges. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Cindy Hahn answered your calls. John Keimel ran the board, and we had help from the MPBN web team. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.